Yeah. What I'm going to talk about is actually, in some sense, build upon what Mark has been talked about. That is to say, we have these many, many different phases. And what I'm interested in here is really to think about what are the possible transition pathways connecting these different phases. And before I start, I'd like to acknowledge my collaborators. Actually, this talk is mainly about the method instead of the problem. And the method is a string method invented by Wilan Yi and his co-workers. I learned it from him. And also, Wilan and Professor Pingwen Zhang worked on the block copolymer transition pathways, which I'm going to talk about. And also, Jianfeng Li and Max Muller, we worked on some other problems using the same method. Now, here's a little introduction, outline of what I'm going to talk about. First of all, I'll do a little introduction, and then really I'd like to spend a bit more time to introduce the method, which is, we call it a string method. And then I'll do a case study, which is the transitions between different phases of block copolymers, which Mark gave a very nice introduction. So that's really nice about talking after him. And I can stop whenever, when there's time. Now, when we think about the different phases and the phase transitions, one way to think about it is in terms of a free energy landscape. So this is a schematic of a very simple free energy landscape. And of course, then we can have a stable phase. We can have metal stable phases. We can have saddle points, which correspond to unstable phases. So the question I'm asking is really thinking about what is the best, the pathways or most probable transition paths connecting different phases. So that's really the question I'm trying to address. Now, in terms of thinking about the transition mechanism, we can actually think about two. One, which I'm not going to talk about, is that when the original phase was driven into unstable phase, that is to say, if it's driven to the saddle point or just somewhere here, then the question is what would be the most probable direction the transition would occur. And what you do there is you can do a linear stability analysis of that structure. And from that, the smallest eigenmode of the fluctuations, you can tell, first of all, if that smallest eigenmode is zero or negative, then the structure is absolutely unstable, and then the transition will occur spontaneously, corresponding to spin order decomposition dynamics. And also, the mode itself tells us which direction the transition would occur. This is actually one example where if you have a lamellar phase which is driven into unstable against the cylindrical phase, then what would be the mode look like? And there's lots of work in that topic, so I'm not going to talk about that. What I'm going to focus today is actually the other side of this kinetics, which is that if the original phase is a metal stable phase. Now, in this case, of course, in terms of the linear stability analysis, the most unstable mode will have an eigenvalue which is larger than zero. So that's how you decide whether it's metal stable or not. And then in this case, the transition will occur through typically nucleation and growth process. Now, in terms of nucleation and growth theory, of course, what we know is the classical nucleation theory, which is a textbook material. Very simple. What you assume is that in a metal stable mother phase, you nucleate a nucleus of the daughter phase. And then you look at the bulk energy and the surface energy, and you look at the competition, and then you find out that there's a critical nucleus, and that energy difference will be the barrier to nucleate a critical nucleus. And once you have a critical a nucleus which has a size larger than the critical nucleus, then the growth will occur. So that's a textbook picture, very, very simple. But the key point here is actually assuming that the nucleus is a sphere and or some determined shape. And what that means is really we are determining reaction coordinates. And if we have a system, for example, if we have a phase transition from one isotropic phase to the other isotropic phase, then it's reasonable to assume the nucleus is a sphere and this program would work. But on the other hand, in general, the free energy landscape is, actually this is what I like, this picture. The free energy landscape is something more complicated than that. And then in this sense, you have your metal stable phase here, you have your stable phase there, and the most probable transition path would be this path, which is the very valley connecting the two, which is something we call the minimal energy path. And then, effectively, the classical nucleation theory I described is assuming that all the states, all these dots, along this path is a sphere. And that's, of course, not a reasonable assumption for isotropic phases we are talking about. So then the question is, how can we determine in a complex landscape like this, determine this path? And then, of course, there's one way, which is sort of, you can think you start from one point and then you look around, you calculate the local curvature of your free energy surface, and then you decide the next step to go. So that's one way, but that's not very efficient. And the string method is actually a better way, in my opinion, to find this path. The idea of string method is that you populate the landscape with a number of states which form a string. And then you let these strings slide down the free energy landscape. So then it will slap onto this path. So that's basically the idea. It's a very, very simple idea, actually. And mathematically, what you do is, of course, is that if you have a free, first of all, you initialize the string, that is to say you populate the phase space with a bunch of states, most efficiently with the starting state as, say, your mother phase, and the state is the daughter phase, and then using some sort of interpolation technique to fill up the states in between. So you populate that, and then you just let the states evolve according to the gradient of the free energy surface. Now, if you don't constrain the evolution, then of course everything on one side will fall to one minima, everything on the other side will fall to the other minima. So what you do is actually you need to use some sort of constraint to say there's some constraint that this state has to form a string. And the simplest constraint is to say they are equally spaced on the string, so that would be this constraint. And mathematically, you use you can use a Lagrangian multiply to enforce that. But in practice, actually, it's very simple. You just do it in two steps. You let it evolve, and then mathematically, it's like, in practice, it's very simple. First of all, you let it evolve according to the gradient for a number of steps, and then you check whether they are equally spaced or whatever your constraint on the string. If they're not, then you adjust the position of this state on the string to make them equally spaced again. And then you just go on. Once you reach a steady state, you'll get it. So that's really the method. And this is the method I'm talking, and I really think like it. And I think it can be very useful to many systems. Now, here is one simple example to illustrate the method. And here I have a function which has two minima, and it has a minimal energy path. You can calculate everything analytically, of course. This is a simple two-dimensional thing. And then this one will be the one I start my initial state, and then there's no constraint. So I let it evolve, and of course, in the end of the day, all the state will go to the two minima, and of course, one at the top will stay at the top. There's no fluctuation here. But on the other hand, if I start use the equal space constraint, then you will see that by the end of the day, it will get snapped onto the minimal energy path, which corresponds to this one. And so that's the method. I must say that this method applies to a lot of problems where you have two minima and you'd like to find the minimal energy path. And also, of course, here I'm specifying a free energy functional, and that's actually not necessary. You can apply it to Monte Carlo system, because what's important here is not the free energy itself, but the gradient of the free energy. And in simulations, using constrained simulations, you can actually calculate the gradient. So in the next, in the rest of the talk, what I'm going to do is to basically show and tell about the applying these to the Brock copolymers. I'm not going to spend lots of time on this because Mark has given a very nice introduction to the system. The only thing I'm going to say is that there's these different phases, and then there's a phase transition between all these different phases. So the question we are interested in is really the new creation of the transition path between these different phases. So that's basically what we are interested in and worked on. And the free energy functional we used is actually the self-consistent field theory of free energy, which has an expression here. And actually, in the formulation here, the variables are the concentrations and the conjugate fields. In practice, actually, what we did was we followed what, again, Mark mentioned in his talk, which is that you change the system into two fields, omega 1 and omega plus and omega minus. And then we enumerated the omega plus using the incompressibility condition. Then you end up with one variable, which is omega minus. And what we did is actually use that to construct the free energy landscape and then apply the string method to the system. Now, the first thing we did was to look at the transition from disordered phase to the spherical phase. The spherical phase is actually a BCC spherical lattice. And so here, these are the parameters we used. And basically, it's a string which we can construct for different values of chi n. So you start with the disordered phase, and these endpoints are actually the BCC phase. And the result is kind of boring, actually, in the sense that, of course, we can measure what the critical point nucleus is and what's the energy barrier. So these are the information we get. And also, we get the information about the critical nucleus, which looks more or less like a sphere in this case. So it's sort of like just show we can do it, but the result is not very interesting in some sense. And the second example is that if I start with a laminar phase and the stable phase is actually a cylinder, and then the first question is, first of all, what would be the new critical nucleus look like? It's not going to be a sphere. If it's not a sphere, what it is? It turns out that the critical nucleus in this case is actually a lens-like object. And that's actually in agreement with our previous study used of this same system using classical nucleation theory. That's just there. What we did is we calculated the interfacial tension as a function of orientation and then use Wolf construction to find the equilibrium shape. And it's exactly like this. And then if we connect the, this is a little, if we connect the, the states. This is not the real dynamics. It's the states connecting the states on the string. So you can see the transition. And the rest is really kind of like repeating everything we did. For example, here is we start with a spherical phase. It's going to transition into a cylindrical phase. Then you ask what would be the critical nucleus. It looks like an egg, actually. And then you can look at the, of course, you can look at the energetics. And also, you can look at the structural relation of the critical nucleus. So just going through very quickly, we did this for gyroids, two cylinders. And again, here the shape is the critical shape. Shape is more like a polygon, and again, sort of like a more or less corresponding to the symmetry of the different faces. And again, here is one connection of the states from the original to the last one, and you can see that. Now, so and also we can calculate. This would be, these are the projections of the different surfaces of a nucleus and the mother phase. And I plot this here is because these are the things which experimentalists can observe from their experiments. So that could be useful. Now, I'd like to finish with the last example, which is kind of interesting example, because the example I showed all have one maximum or one critical state, and also one sort of nice transition path. So the question is that are there all? Can there be more than one path? So, and actually the answer is yes. And here is one very interesting example, which is a lamellar phase to gyroids. And there, indeed, we found two transition paths. And the first path, the black one, sort of follow the usual picture where you have a nucleus of the gyroids and then the gyroids just grow. But on the other hand, we found there's another path, which is the blue one. And the blue one actually, first of all, it starts to nucleate something like this, and this will grow to a minimum, which actually corresponds to the hexagonal perforated layered structure. And then in the layered structure, you got a second nucleation of the gyroids, and the gyroids grow. So that's the second path. And of course, in reality, the system will start with the one with the smaller energy barrier. So in reality, this calculation predicts the transition will go through the hexagonal perforated layered structure, then go to the gyroid, and that's actually what the observation says. Then the last thing is I still have this picture, which is connecting, and that's just just showing again showing the two stage of the transition, and that's all. Yeah, I'm not going to read it. That's it. Thank you.
So, do we have questions for Professor Shi? First here, then Michelle after.
Hi. I had a question about this string method. Mm-hmm. Well, two part, I guess. One is whether if you impose this constraint that little sections are equidistant, doesn't that create kind of like a line tension, and wouldn't that sort of keep you from?
Yes, it does create a line tension, because another way, there are other methods to do this, which is you assume it's an elastic string, and then you can do that. But the problem with the elastic string is that how do you keep the constant, the elastic constant?
Right. But it gets close enough that you're happy with the.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Michelle, I don't know if I can.
Yeah, just. Sorry.
So you mentioned that this method can be used for Monte Carlo simulation,
yes.
Right? So
yes.
Can you mention one or two examples where this have been used?
We actually, that's the work Max Muller and I did. The problem we were interested was actually two vesicles closing together and how they fuse into one. And the model there is a Monte Carlo simulation model. And in the Monte Carlo simulations, there's no free energy on the fly. But on the other hand, because the string evolves according to the gradient of the free energy, which is the chemical potential. And in the Monte Carlo simulations, you can compute the chemical potential by constraint a density, a prefixed density, and do random Monte Carlo simulations within that constraint. And that gives you the chemical potential. And then we evolve the string according to that chemical potential.
Okay, we thank Professor Shi again.
Thank you.